Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and the oil on my apex. It's Dave Vitti.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance.
Now, don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Podcasts? You see,
yes, I've got it now.
You have got it, and it's brilliant that after we're nearly at the end of our ninth series, and I'm delighted that you know that they are called a podcast.
So, Dave, what's been going on? I hear you've made little motoring purchase maybe last week, perhaps.
I might have got myself a new set of wheels. Yes. So for those that didn't hear this episode, my previous whip decided to overheat on me and needed a new water pump, which was going to cost me about £1,000. I wasn't going to go down that, so I got rid of the Beamer, and I've now got myself a little secondhand Scirocco GT, which I'm very happy with.
Our guest, who we'll speak to in a minute, he knows about Sciroccos.
Does he now?
In fact, I'm pretty sure he had one himself. I'm pretty sure he did.
Well, I mean, we should ask this question in a second, shouldn't we, of our guest? Because not only does he know about Sciroccos, presumably, but he also knows about pretty much everything when it comes to four wheels. But I think you should introduce him properly.
I think I will. Now, our guest today is a highly respected motorsport broadcaster, writer, and occasional racer. Essentially, he's the voice of racing. And what he doesn't know about, that is... Yeah, I mean, he knows about everything in it. He's like a motor racing Rolodex. Everything in there from years gone by, he's got it covered. He's pretty rapid behind the wheel himself. It is, of course, my very good friend, Mr. Ben Edwards. Hello, mate. How are you?
Hi, JP. Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Really good to see you both. Really looking forward to it.
Absolutely, Ben. Thank you very much for joining us today after what we can say is a pretty significant weekend in the world of motorsport, with the Formula One season wrapping up in Abu Dhabi as the Formula E season 2024-2025 got underway in Sao Paulo. And at the time of recording, you've just arrived back from Brazil, jet fresh. How was it?
It was actually pretty dramatic. It was they've introduced some new technology this year with four-wheel drive, with the attack mode, and it was actually very effective. So now, when in the past, attack mode has sometimes hurt the drivers because they have to run wide to get extra power, and then they get the extra power, but it's not always enough to do much. It makes a big difference now. And when they went into attack mode, they could overtake several cars on a couple of laps. It was quite impressive. And but there were incidents as well. There were a couple of red flags. It was quite a delayed race. But then to see it being won from the guy who had qualified at the very back of the grid, because he didn't manage to get a lap in qualifying because there was a technical problem with the car, and he ended up winning. So it was pretty exciting, yeah.
Wow. And who was that, Ben? Who won? I've not caught up with it yet.
It was the Kiwi, Mitch Evans, who's always one of the front runners.
Ah, okay. Yeah.
He couldn't get going in qualifying. Well, he tried to, but the car just stopped out on track, and he did get it back in eventually, but they couldn't run it in qualifying. And so he started from the back. He wasn't expecting to win, but he did. He did.
Good Lord. Well, I'm hoping. I mean, he got back just after the race, and obviously all the way back from Brazil. That's a long flight. I'm hoping you've found time to catch up with the F1, the final in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, I certainly did. I was watching it on my way back, actually. And I have to say, I'm very happy for McLaren. Very, very happy for McLaren to have won that.
Me too.
Constructors, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. I mean, I mean, I'm sure, like you, Dave. Obviously, not like you, Ben, because you know all this stuff. Oh my God, it's so long since they won a manufacturers' championship,
isn't it?
I couldn't believe that when it popped on the TV, like 25-30 years.
Yeah, long time, wasn't it? And as I say, you know, the thing with Abu Dhabi, obviously, you know, Max winning the Drivers' Championship, but it was all about McLaren and all about Lando this last weekend, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It really was, yeah. Yeah, no, he did an outstanding job. You know, he did everything that needed to be done, controlled it beautifully, and all the battles were going on behind him. And there were some interesting stuff going on. Actually, well, funnily enough, JP, when I saw the start, I thought, oh, that's what I've got to ask you about. Because you did see the start, presumably, and the incident that Max... Yeah, the Max had straight away with Piastri. What were your thoughts on that?
It's Max. I'm a great fan of Max in the round, but I'm not a fan of him when he's not on pole position or not in the lead, because he's a bit over. He's a bit over aggressive. I mean, if you look at that, if you look from on board his car, that move was never on, never on in a million years. Personally, I think I blame his team actually, because I can't believe that Christian Horner has ever pulled him up and gone, now look here. It's never 100% right or wrong. There's nuance. And there's, let's just say it might be 60-40. They've never had that conversation with Max. He just does what he likes. If I'm honest, I think he's a bit out of control.
Just sometimes, yes. Just sometimes he overdoes it. And I understand. I understand what you're saying. I mean, that I did feel that was his mistake. You know, he went for the inside line. He actually ran it too wide on exit because he went in too quick, and there was nothing Piastri could do to avoid that because he was staying on line. So, and he got the penalty. Fair enough. But
Do you know what? That mistake from Max shouldn't be the mistake of a four-time world champion. That's a mistake where someone in their first couple of years would make. And do you know what? That's okay to make that mistake then, because you're learning your craft.
So, Jason, what you're saying is, with his experience, then you just think that he shouldn't have made that mistake, you know.
And
ultimately, was that all to do with the speed at which he entered that corner, therefore being so much so, it's always going to run in wide?
Absolutely, but also, I honestly believe Red Bull. We need to hold them to account as well, because I can't imagine anyone ever knowing what his dad's like. I can't imagine anybody would pull him up for anything. So he just doesn't care. He doesn't care. And that's admirable, but not from a four-time world champion.
Interesting. No, interesting. I totally get it.
Or I should say three-time, really, but let's not start. Oh, no, actually, that's a great segue. Wasn't Lewis utterly brilliant?
He did a fantastic job. No, he did a really, really good job. And he's... You know, his use of tyres in races and stuff in the past has often been a really good move. And yes, they going for that slightly different strategy and then working it so well in the latter stages. It was a great shame that qualifying hadn't gone well for him. That was that little incident. That was such
I know. How great was that overtake round turn, whatever it is, where when he overtook George? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Right on the outside. Yeah. I mean.
Incredible.
He's still Very got impressive. It, hasn't he? Very much so.
Yeah, and what a way as well to obviously sort of sign off, you know, in terms of sort of leaving that team and whatnot. I mean, what a way to actually sort of, I think it was a reminder, wasn't it, to everybody, you know, while Lando and McLaren quite rightly sort of stole all the headlines yesterday, it was a little bit like, I'm still here, you know, and I'm still an incredible driver.
And he's so close to, you know, in a way, it was a shame he didn't get a final podium for Mercedes in his last run. But it was still so impressive that, you're absolutely right in getting past George like that. I mean, fantastic and a great way to end it, because he's been through a bit of a tough patch, hasn't he? You know, coming in this last part of the year, it has been a tough patch. He's not been happy with the feel of the car. You just feel he's just not had that confidence in it. But suddenly there he was, back to his normal state. I was commentating earlier this year actually on the British Grand Prix when he won, and that really was special. Because Jason, you know, mate, in the wet he is astonishing, and he still is, and that was part of him winning at Silverstone.
Like you say, he has come under enormous, you know, in his orbit. God, he's been under some flak, hasn't he, really, and a lot of inner pressure and a lot of demons to deal with himself, because we're all human. Yeah, we're all just regular people. I mean, he's a regular person, got regular feelings, and yet he's dealt with it. And you know what? I was really pleased he managed to put that performance together, because he needed that to go onwards, I think. So yeah, hopefully that shut his doubters up, because he had a few of those.
Yeah. It's going to be fascinating to see how he gets on with Leclerc, how the combination goes at Ferrari. That is going to be something that everybody's going to be very, very interested in for the start of next year.
Yeah, well, this is what I was going to say, actually, Ben. I mean, in terms of, you know, with Lewis going to Ferrari, and obviously in terms of where Lando finds himself at the moment, and obviously sort of George coming through, et cetera, et cetera. it's set up perfectly, is it not, for the next season? I mean, this season's been an absolute cracker, but the next one, in terms of, you know, if we see this as a performance, we were talking to Mark Priestley the other week, and we've had Jenny Gow on as well recently, and sort of talking to both of them, and in so much as, obviously, there's a real effort to make the sport sort of more appealing to the Americans and more of a show, and when you think about it as a show and as a production and with all the sort of the cast and crew, it is set up beautifully, is it not, as a spectacle going forwards?
It is. There's no doubt. There's a lot to look forward to into next year, particularly it being the last year of the current regulations. And as we have seen, teams have now managed to catch up with Red Bull, because for a while under these regulations, Red Bull was so dominant. Even when we started this year, it looked, oh, here we go again. It looked like Red Bull were going to dominate, and they did not. And they lost the constructors. They won the drivers. But, you know, Max, as ever, was superb. There were a couple of races, particularly in Brazil, when it was Formula One in Brazil, again in the rain, where he did a stunning event. And really, in many ways, that was the race where he kind of put the McLaren people out of the drivers' constructors, you know, because by then he had plenty of points ahead. And that was a fascinating race. But next year, you're absolutely right, because the teams are definitely getting there in terms of making the cars much more competitive with Red Bull. Red Bull were clearly struggling a bit. And I think, yeah, it's going to be wide open going into next year, which is fantastic, really to look forward to.
Amazing, isn't it? Towards the end of every regulation cycle, they all catch up, and they're all actually on the pace now, aren't they? I mean, look at the Hulk, Hulkenberg, his performance this weekend. Unbelievable.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it was also close this year. And you just got to wonder, how is it going to be in that final, as you say, the final year of this technology, where in theory all the teams are on top of it? Mind you, you say that, sometimes a team will suddenly find something and just take a little step ahead. But I think it's much harder when you get to this final stage. They've all tried things. They've all experimented. They've all seen what the other team has done now. So they've all caught up with Red Bull to a certain extent. And now it's proper racing. When we go into 2026, it might be a completely different story with new powertrain systems. It could be one or two teams that dominate. You just can't tell. But yeah, I'm impressed by how close the championship fighting is, how close the lap time differences are amazing now.
I mean, it is unbelievable, isn't it? I mean, you know, some of our viewers perhaps won't understand, like, say, me and you do, and Dave does, but, you know, to go around a, I don't know how long Abu Dhabi is, but all the circuits of recent years, to go round where the top six at the end of qualifying are separated by maybe 2 or 3 tenths of a second. That's impressive when you think of the scope that all the Formula One teams have got with the rules and regulations, what they can and can't do, all the different budgets. It's really on the button, is it, at the moment?
I agree with that, you know, because, you know, in Formula One, each team is a completely separate unit. Yes, there are some teams that use motor power from elsewhere, like McLaren using Mercedes power, but it's a very different machine, and yet they're so even. I like you, I'm astonished. Yes, they use the same tyres, but that's about it, you know.
No, and it just goes to, you know, it's credit again to the likes of McLaren and whatnot, you know, the fact that they've actually sort of made up that difference. And it's such fine margins, isn't it? But now to be at a point where it is so equally balanced between the teams and the drivers, as I say, that's exactly what the sport should all be about, you know, and it's wonderful to see.
It is wonderful to see. And you know, Ferrari have done a pretty good job this year as well. They didn't end up managing to nip McLaren at the end, you know. I did wonder, I'm sure a lot of people did, when Piastri and Verstappen had the initial incident, you know, that suddenly if something had happened then to Lando, then it could have all changed. But he held it all together so well that McLaren got it and thoroughly deserved it. But I think it's encouraging that Ferrari have had a much stronger time. And when Lewis goes there next year, is he going to be at Ferrari at the right time when they're actually in the position to fight for it?
Yeah, this is what I was going to say to you, actually, Jason. From your point of view, do you think, given you know, how close it all is and how well Ferrari have done, do you think that Lewis going there could just be the final piece of the jigsaw to actually sort of, you know, get them over the line, do you think?
Absolutely, yes, I do. I really do think that. and it's interesting, isn't it? You know, you listen to what Lewis said post-race on the radio, which was delightful, you know, to hear his, you know, his love for that team. And it is a love. It's a genuine love for Mercedes. But, you know, I remember when he made the move from McLaren to Mercedes and everyone thought he was absolutely off his head, including me. And yet, and maybe he revealed something yesterday, on the weekend, which was where he said, look, I did a leap of faith and it all worked out. And that was a really interesting thing I picked up on there, because I think it was a leap of faith. I think he was inspired by Toto, but primarily by, God bless him, Niki Lauda, who said, look, come on, let's make this thing, let's make this team great. I mean, I hate using that expression because the lunatic in America does, but you know what I mean. I think he's created something there, and I do think he's a brilliant team player. He's great at galvanising everyone around him. Ferrari's a different beast, obviously, but I do think, I got a funny feeling he's got it right again, you know.
Well, we shall see. That's fascinating that you think that, yeah. I think it's going to be an exciting time. And we know that it is going to be interesting with him against Leclerc. Leclerc's a very good single lap driver, there's no doubt. He's very rapid on a single lap. And so the competition will be tough between them. But then, as we know, Lewis, like he was yesterday, so good in a race when things come his way, when the car's feeling right. His race pace can be stunning still, obviously, as we've seen this year several times.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting because not only, we saw it demonstrated in that sort of single act in terms of the overtake yesterday that Lewis pulled off, just as a reminder, in case anybody was under any doubt about his ability. But then obviously with him going to Ferrari, not only does he bring that experience and that ability to still do it at the absolute top level, but also from a team point of view, the arrival of somebody of the status in world motorsport as Lewis Hamilton will also give the entire team a lift, won't it? If nothing else, for want of the feel-good factor and the general confidence, of being able to really, really rub shoulders with the big boys.
Yes, but I did gather that, in fact, not all of the Italian fans were 100% happy when they heard the news that Lewis was going to be going to Ferrari. This was announced quite a lot earlier in the year. Some were very excited, some I think a little less so. So I think it will be very interesting to see how it develops, and it could go either way, really. We never can predict these things. When you go to a new team, Jason, when you go to a new team to work with them in that way where you totally understand each other, that takes a few races, because just the quick moment you're talking to your engineer, that can and it can throw you sometimes, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. It's going to be interesting to see who is his engineer, because obviously he's worked with Bono for so many years, and that driver, that interface between engineer and driver. I mean, I know, thinking back to my career, when I had everything just going so sweetly, do you know what? It wasn't a difference in me, really. It was, I just had that perfect connection mentally and kind of, I don't want to use the word spiritually, but kind of, because they, when they're speaking to you on the radio in the car, you can't really express yourself. It's all quite succinct and monologue, and yet he could look at me in the eyes when I said something and know exactly what I meant. And that bond, if you like, a bit like a rally driver and a co-driver. It's that closeness, that total understanding of each other. That's going to take some time, for sure.
Yeah. I agree with that. And I think that can sometimes be a difficult thing when you first go with a team. And it can be frustrating because you've said something which you know what you mean, but they've taken it in a different direction because they didn't quite understand it.
I was going to say, tell you what is interesting. And I don't know, you might have been there as well, Ben, but I've been over to Ferrari doing car film for fifth gear and prior to that with Driven. And I've been over to inside of Fiorano, the track, and been to... was allowed into Enzo's house, his old house there. And I remember walking in and you go in his office and it's just like it was the day he died. And there's one picture on the desk and his purple felt-tip pen's there, because he used to write everything in purple felt-tip pen. And the picture is of Gilles Villeneuve. However, Michael had, Michael wasn't at Ferrari. He'd gone when I was there. One of the bedrooms, which was Enzo's room, was still Michael's room. And now I hear Lewis has been offered that room as a kind of a welcoming gift. I mean, that's special. So I think Ferrari are excited, for sure.
I suppose the flip side of that, and going back to the point that you made a couple of minutes ago, Ben, with regards to certain Ferrari fans perhaps not being quite so excited about the prospects of Lewis's arrival, do you think that that is because they would perceive it as possibly being a bit of a swan song in his career, and therefore, you know, a bit of almost a bit like how would you describe it? Almost a bit like a sort of victory lap, if we want for want of a better expression, whereby they would feel that perhaps the team should be investing in, you know, the new blood, you know, and the future, as opposed to maybe offering somebody a sort of victory lap. I don't know. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of by way of negativity towards his arrival.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that is the element of negativity. Ferrari fans love seeing new youngsters coming through and being dominant if they can. I do think, and as I say, there is still plenty of support for Lewis, but I do think there is a bit of a mix. And some people are feeling, well, Lewis is, you know, he's been at the very top for a long, long time. Surely now he's getting towards the end of his career. Why do we need him in Ferrari now? You know, is he going to be the right guy? Commercially, I think it's actually been a very good thing for Ferrari to do that. But from a fan point of view, I think there will be a few questions. So that will put him under a little bit of pressure, I guess. But we shall see. I mean, what's also fun, it's always fun seeing new drivers coming into the sports. And it's good to know that Formula One's got various new drivers coming in next year. And funnily enough, doing this Formula E this weekend, this was the first round of the new season. There was a youngster called Taylor Barnard, who lives in my part of the world up in Norfolk, comes from Norwich in Norfolk. He's only 20 years old. He's taken his first podium. It's only his, I think it's his fourth race. He stood in for Sam Bird a couple of times last year. He's into his first full season and he got a podium. And, you know, when youngsters, rookies do that well, it is great. And to, you know, it's lovely that there are some new names coming into Formula One next year as well.
And of course, with Lewis departing to Ferrari, it's opened up a seat at Mercedes and young
Antonelli.
Antonelli, that's his surname, yeah. Antonelli's coming in. Who's an exciting young prospect, isn't he?
Indeed. Absolutely right. No, that's absolutely right. And you're going to see a new rivalry there. I mean, George is clearly going to be the sort of team leader now that Lewis is leaving. But Kimi Antonelli is a real talent. Yes, he had a bit of an unfortunate run when he first did an official event.
Oh, Monza, bless him.
Yes. But he is talented. We've seen him do some pretty amazing stuff coming up through the ranks. So that's going to be very interesting, yeah.
It's timely, actually, Ben, that you sort of talk about Formula E again, because I was going to ask you about this with relation to Formula One as well. Do you think that, you know, there will be a day where Formula E replaces Formula One, or do you think the two can exist and coexist side by side?
I get the feeling that, yeah, they can coexist. I can't see it replacing Formula One myself, but I do think it has a real value to it. And I was interested in being at the event. I've commentated on Formula E a couple of times, but I've done it from London. It was a sort of short notice that I had to go and do some commentary a couple of years ago. And then I got plenty of notice for this one and they asked if I could go along. And actually, it's a very good environment. I enjoyed being in the paddock. There is a relationship between drivers from different teams and even between teams, because, of course, so many of them have moved from one team to another, whether that's a driver or engineer or mechanics. And so they fight. There's huge competitiveness, but there is also connection. And I actually quite enjoyed that aspect of it. It is something you don't see so much in Formula One, because Formula One is the very top of the board of motor racing, and everybody does their own thing and they're kind of wrapped up in their own way, which I totally understand as well. And it's hugely worldwide significant, but they are slightly different. So Formula E and Formula One are slightly different. I think they can coexist in quite a useful way, and that Formula E is learning a lot about electrical power. There's no doubt the way they've moved on from in 10 years from a car that couldn't even do a race. You had to come into the pits, get into another car and go back out again in another car. And now they're doing some decent speed with this four-wheel drive boost thing that they can do as well. They're watching the cars when they were in boost system around Sao Paulo. It was actually exciting to watch them. They're sliding, slipping. They're really proving to be now quite challenging. It's good.
Ah, brilliant. That's great to know. I mean, I'll catch up at the race this week. I've got it on record. Because they didn't look fast enough. And it's great you say they're now looking, a bit edgy. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different to Formula One. There's no doubt for me, but it's fun.
So look, Ben, obviously I mentioned at the intro, and I know for certain that Ben was pretty rapid behind the wheel himself. How often do you get on track, Ben? Are you still doing the odd few things?
And occasionally, yeah. Funnily enough, I decided to just go back to doing a little bit of instructing now and then, because I just love being on a track every now and then. I used to be an instructor at Brands Hatch for some years.
Well, that's where we met, wasn't it?
Yeah, it probably was. And that was a long time ago. I still have, a few years ago, I bought a Formula Ford to go and have a play with every now and then.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah, and I haven't been out in it at all this year. I'm hoping I get out in it next year. I would love to do the Formula Ford Festival at Brands Hatch, which takes place in October.
Yeah.
That would be something I'd love to do again. So getting out, and I do an occasional track day with some friends or something. So, yeah, you know, it still matters to me, but I'm not out there trying to prove anything much anymore, you know. I had a go at racing, and I did reasonably well, but I didn't do it nothing like the level you did, Jason.
Oh, that's very kind of you to say.
I actually want to ask you a bit more about this, Ben, in a second, but quick bit of mid-show housekeeping, folks, if I may. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from. So, Ben, in terms of your own racing career then, was that the initial plan and focus before commentating took centre stage and obviously took you in the direction for which you're best known?
Absolutely, really, yes. I mean, I first got involved in motor racing, funnily enough, being a mechanic, but a sort of go-to mechanic, just I'd started helping cleaning a Formula Ford cars that a guy near me used to run at Brands Hatch in the championship of Brands in Formula Fords. And he was a lovely guy called Rob Creswell, who actually won his drivers, won several championships in that Champion of Brands series. Chris Ringrose is still a good friend of mine. He was one of them.
I know that name, Rob Creswell. I don't know why, but it's a name that's in my scattered brain.
Yeah, and he was a lovely guy to work with. So that sort of got me going in motorsport a little bit. And once I had been mechanicking with him, I just wanted to go racing. And I managed to do a little bit of Formula Ford racing. I couldn't really afford to do much, but I did a bit of Formula Ford racing. And it was in what was called the pre-74 series. So it was historic Formula Fords. Did okay. And then I was looking to sort of continue into Formula Ford. And then Formula First was created. It was a new little single-seater series that was created by the Brands Hatch group. And the cars were built by Van Diemen. They were all identical. And I, very luckily, actually it was Rob Creswell's brother, Chris Creswell, who ran a team.
That's why I know the name.
Yeah.
That's why it's Chris Creswell. I know that's why I know, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, he helped me because I couldn't afford to buy a car. But he said, oh, well, I can afford to buy a car, you can run it, and if you win the championship, then I get the prize money and the car back. And that's what happened. I did actually win the championship. I won the first Formula First.
I remember. I tell you what, though, you mentioned the Formula First. They weren't pretty looking things, were they?
No. They had a transverse rear engine, and so the rear bodywork, it didn't have any rear bodywork even initially, and then it had a huge rear bodywork. Yeah, they weren't pretty. And they weren't easy either. A lot of people had a lot of accidents. Thankfully, it was usually all right up front, but there were some big, big crashes.
Oh, wow. And what year was that, Ben? I know I should never ask that, but what year was that?
That was 1987.
87, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it was a similar time when you were, you know, sort of building your career. And we were going in different directions at that point. And I actually, because I managed to get
literally.
A sponsor. Yeah. I managed to get a sponsor. I was very lucky. I got a sponsor locally, and I went into what was called Formula Vauxhall Lotus from Formula First. And so that was quite a big jump up from Formula First to Formula Vauxhall Lotus. Formula Vauxhall Lotus is a bit like Formula Renault these days. It's a fairly serious single-seater step. And I did struggle more with that initially. I mean, I occasionally had pace, but I didn't have the consistency in Formula Vauxhall Lotus. But it was wonderful because I was racing in both the UK and the European series. And I was racing, against Mika Häkkinen and Alan McNeish, for example, people like that. And then I carried on a bit longer, where they moved on very quickly and to the next level. I raced against David Coulthard, who later on, of course, I would end up commentating with for many years.
Well, do you know, it's funny actually, because we've had obviously the likes of David Coulthard on here and various other people, Johnny Herbert as well. I remember having this conversation with, in terms of, you know, because people don't always realize that all drivers, however high they sort of reach on the ladder, if you like, of motorsport success, they've all had to find their own funding at some point in order to enable their career to go forward. The risk of oversimplifying the story, do you think that was the case with you, Ben, in so much as had the right opportunity come around at the right time in terms of, you know, somebody to provide the funding for you, that actually, you know, you could have actually made it as a driver?
Possibly. I mean, you know, I was very lucky. I found this sponsor, Blue Lamp, and they did a great job with for me for Vauxhall Lotus. I didn't really deliver quite enough at that time. I jumped into a Formula 3 car in Spain. They were a year old Formula 3 cars in Spain, and I actually did well in that event. It sort of suited me better. I was still trying. I was still aiming to get further as a driver. But by this point, the sponsorship had sort of run out, understandably, and I was struggling then to really, and that was the time I started getting into commentating. I actually I was at Brands Hatch as an instructor early on, and Brian, the commentator there, he was a lovely man. He kind of encouraged me to do it, because I'd helped him a couple of times, and he said, "Well, you're pretty good at this, you know, do a bit more." And that's what got me into commentating. And for a while, I was doing both commentating and trying to go racing. When I stopped single seaters, I raced Caterhams for a year, and because at that point they were doing Caterhams with star drivers guesting for one race.
I did one. I jumped in one at Donington. Yeah, in the red tops. You know, the red top engines, which was the Vauxhall twin cam. Yeah, Vauxhall twin cam engine. I jumped in there.
That's right.
In their celebi car.
Was that the first race of the year you did?
It was. Yeah, Donington, which I won. It was brilliant. It was one that obviously. Did I mention I won that race? Did I mention?
Yeah, but it was. Surprised.
Do you know what? I tell you what was amazing was the camaraderie in the paddock between teams. We had a little problem, and someone come up and said, "Oh, look, it's okay. If that car doesn't work, you can have ours." Pardon?
My only driving experience at Brands actually was in a Caterham, and I famously managed to completely trash it. I'd been lent this Caterham, and I managed to snap the back axle on it, right? Because
no.
I came down the hill, you know, by the main grandstand, and then that sharp left there. And the thing was, it was like an open track day. So I had some fella in an M3 or something right up my backside coming down there. And of course, made the fatal mistake of looking behind me rather than in terms of where my line was going. I gave it too much beans on the left-hander, lost the back end, spun round and hit the grass, and then just ended up going backwards across wet grass into the thing. And the whole back axle was...
Oh,
it had
no.
to be towed off with the owner there as I was sort of stood there, cap in hand, kind of going, "Sorry about that." Yeah.
Oh, do you know what, Dave? We've all done a few pranks over the years, but isn't it just the worst feeling?
Mm.
Yeah.
You know,
no, I know what you mean.
Like, even just before you hit the wall, even though you know it's gone, you're still trying to wrestle it. And then when it just goes in, the noise is just horrific, isn't it?
I know. And it seems to, that whole, even though it's, you know, you're talking about sort of fractions of a second or something, but that, it's like any kind of accident, isn't it? Like when you have a car accident on the road, it just seems to, everything seems to slow down and you're just kind of there, just careering completely out of control, and then until you hit something, and then unfortunately, yeah, that was the axle gone.
So here's a great question, Dave and Ben. Why do you think that is? Why do you think during that moment of stress or having an accent, why does time slow down? Why is that?
There's systems in the body, aren't there, and in the mind that when there's this massive kick of kind of adrenaline, but other aspects that are going on in a huge incident, because you see it, you know, you're absolutely right. As a racing driver, when you have a crash, everything slows down. Or even, as you say, people on the road who have a crash. It's also, you see it in other people who are rescuing people in a dramatic moment and realising they're lifting something up that when they go back and try and lift it, they can't lift it. How
yes,
do that?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's a really good example.
Yeah. Do you think it's your body sort of preparing itself for what's to come? Because in all the examples that we're sort of given, in terms of like a crash in a car, whether it be on the road or on a track or something like that, your body sort of knows that it's preparing for some kind of impact or some kind of stress or trauma. And maybe that's what it is. Almost it sort of seems to give you longer to prepare yourself for whatever's to come.
Yeah, there are parts of the body that respond more quickly than the brain. You know, that is part of it. And so we don't always know that because we operate through our brains, but our body can sometimes react even more quickly.
See, now I've got a theory on this, and my theory is the very finest racing drivers in the world. And what I'm about to say, I'm not including myself in that category at all. So please don't, please don't, because I'm generally not. I've had it in certain races when everything's been going really brilliantly. I've had it in a race where I just appear to have a bit more time than actually reality says I do. And I think the very greats of this world, when there is a stressful situation, they have the ability to almost turn that on in their mind and just slow everything up. So that's a processing speed. That's a, I don't know what it is, but I think the greats, there is a bodily difference as well, whether that's mental or chemical or I don't know, like a chemical difference in their brain. Because, you know, we've got, I mean, I openly speak about it. My eldest is high functioning autistic. And she can see jigsaw puzzles like I can't. So I think there's definitely something where we're just born with, well, I say we, they, the greats are born with, some difference in their processing power. Do you think that?
I think that, yeah, I do agree. And actually, it's really interesting you say that because Damon Hill wrote a very good autobiography and he refers to a race in Japan where he had exactly what you're talking about there. Everything slowed down. He had every more moment to sort of do what he wanted to do. So he experienced that. But I think he was aware too that there are some people in the world, that the drivers, who almost have that ability to, you know, he's a very honest driver as a world champion.
I think to a certain degree, Lando had that this weekend. I think he had just a little bit. He was really chilled, relaxed. He had more time to just look after stuff.
Yeah. I don't think it happens all the time, even for the top, top greats. But it does happen perhaps a bit more often. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I think we refer to it as the purple patch.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, he's having his purple patch. And that's probably it, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. They use purple lights, actually, in Formula E when they've got this attack mode. So purple patch, you know, it's becoming a thing.
There you go. You see, it's obviously a thing. And also we were talking about the purple biro as well, weren't we, that Enzo used. So the purple is obviously the colour of this episode. Ben, in terms of your escapades off track and sort of in terms of your road driving, where does it all begin? What was the first car for you then?
First car that I had on the road actually was lovely. My mother had bought a car that she used for a little while, but with it kind of in mind to her that to pass it on. And it was called a Suzuki SC100, which not many people will have come across because it was a little 2+2, tiny little Suzuki rear-engined. It was only 1,000cc, so good for a youngster on, you know. It was wonderful. I loved it. And that lasted me for several years. And it was actually a great fun little car. Yeah, great.
So what's in the history then? In you know, from then or any bikes maybe?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I love bikes, but actually part of the deal that she gave me, she said, "I will pass this car on to you as long as you don't ride bikes." And I do understand that because my brother had ridden bikes and had had various incidents. He was fine. Yeah, thankfully, he was fine out of it. But she didn't really want me to go down that same route. And as much as I love bikes, and I used to ride a bike a little bit around a farm and stuff, but I haven't done much biking. I love watching them. I love seeing them. But I've stayed off them a little bit. So in terms of cars, they've always mattered to me, even historic cars, actually, because within the family took on a 1930s car when I was quite young. Because there is a very, very slight family connection to actually a famous man in the world of, he was in the world of motorsports in that time, called Reed Railton. And Railton actually, in those days, even more important than Formula One, was land speed record. You know, that changed over the years. But he created a car that took the land speed record. He also created the Brooklands lap record holder. Anyway, there was a Railton car created in the 1930s with his name. He was only a little bit actually involved in the design. He wasn't hugely involved, but they took his name. And my father, who did actually end up leaving us all quite early in life, but he to somewhere else, not off, didn't die early. But he actually brought in this Railton 10 horsepower. It's a baby Railton little car. So we used to go to events, my brother and I, in this Railton. And that was the first thing I ever went to Brands Hatch. That was the first ever reason I went to Brands Hatch, was in a historic car event. So that was fun. So over the years, I've been a little bit into historic cars and modern cars. I haven't had a massive collection of cars over the years because, you know, going racing and stuff, when that's your thing as well, you tend to go down that route. I had a Triumph Stag for some years, a rather lovely Triumph Stag, which I did enjoy.
Do you reckon any of those are still alive, or do you reckon they're all turned to dust?
This is what I was going to say, because I love the Triumph Stag. I think it is, as you say, visually, it's a beautiful, beautiful car. But whenever I see them, they're always on the side of the road with the bonnet up, you know, yeah. with somebody clearly waiting for support. Yeah.
Mine was fine, though. I have to say, I was very lucky. I bought a good one. It lasts. I didn't do huge mileage with it, but it was always reliable, and then sold it off again. And I believe it's still going all right. So it was actually, I was lucky. It was a very good one. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a great car to have in your history.
Yeah, I've had a Mazda MX-5 Mark 1, which are now I see are going up and up in value quite a lot. And that was fun. It was fun actually just to do a few track days with friends and things, because they're a good learning car. Mm. They're a very good learning car for that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, funny enough, with the MX-5, there's a film that actually I produced for Influx, which is Adrian Flux's sort of channel, a few years ago, and they wanted something on the MX-5 because it is such a beautiful and such an iconic car. And I was trying to find an interesting angle on this. And anyway, with a bit of Google research, I found this fella who's in Italy, who is the world's greatest collector of MX-5s. And I kid you not, in a barn at this farmhouse in the beautiful rolling hills of Umbria, he's got about 50 odd of these. He's got every sort of type of, you know, Mark 1, Mark 2, Mark 3, Mark 4, but then also all the different versions for the Japanese market, for the American market. And he's got this hotel called Miata Land, because in America they're called the Miata. Right?
Indeed.
And so essentially you can go and stay there in this beautiful Umbrian farmhouse and then just take the cars out for a drive. And so we made a little film about him. It's absolutely wonderful. I'll send it to you. But it was one of the best trips. And like, if ever there was an introduction into the MX-5, that was it, because it was just spectacular.
Well, yeah, do send that to me. That sounds fascinating. My nephew is a huge fan of MX-5s. He's still got one. He doesn't think it's going to last much longer, sadly, because it's sort of rotting away. And my stepson has one right now, and he's deciding whether to keep it or not. So yeah, I think, you know, and I understand. I can understand the interest, yeah.
So what then? I mean, because I mentioned at the top of the show before I introduce you that you went down the Scirocco route as well, didn't you? Like Dave is now.
Well, I went, yes, the later Scirocco, that's right. Yes, I did. I always loved the very first Sciroccos too when I was growing up.
Oh, wasn't it a great car?
They were lovely. And then, yes, I had a road-going Scirocco for a while, which was fun. I did enjoy that, I must admit. It was a good car. At the moment, I've got an Alpine, a BMW Alpina.
Oh, right.
Which I've had for a few years. It's probably one of their most humble ones, because it's basically a diesel bi-turbo, and it's only a 2-litre estate, but it really suits me, and it's worked well over the years, and I'm really enjoying it. That's my sort of regular road car.
I love what Alpina do. They just add something lovely to BMWs, don't they?
Yeah, just a little touch. I mean, it's nothing much different.
Yeah, but then as you say, when it's something like a touring as well, you know, it's practical, it's good to drive, it's just got a bit... I love an estate. I love an estate, I really do.
Oh, me too. Me too, actually. I think they're brilliant estates. Mm. I mean, who would think I've kind of got one-ish?
Well, you sort of have, haven't you? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, got
because,
one.
Yeah, the Panamera is kind of an estate, isn't it?
The Sport Hatches thing, the one with the big bum. And normally I don't like big bums, but I do like its.
You know, we often say, Ben, in terms of the love that you've lost in terms of, you know, from a motoring point of view, would you, or lost, or rather, you know, the one that got away, the one that maybe you wish you still had, would the Stag be that for you, or is there something else that sort of jumps out from the motoring history?
Oh, that's a good question, but I've had interest in all sorts of machinery and cars over the years, so I think it's quite difficult to say if there's something particular. I funnily enough, the Caterhams is something I had a go in Caterhams again this year a little bit. My stepson is involved in a business that's actually selling Caterhams secondhand, called Turn 7, and they asked me to drive a couple that I hadn't driven before, and I thought, oh, this is lovely. To get back in one again was really good fun. So, and that was on the road rather than on the track, and it was, yeah, I really enjoyed that.
So it would you say it's been a stinker that you've had? I mean, we've all had them, haven't we? Jesus.
A stinker? What do you mean in terms of?
Well, in terms of a car you've had, which you go, oh, what did I get that for? That's just, it was a headache, do you know what I mean?
Oh, I see what you mean. No, I don't think I've had one of those too much, actually. I had a Lotus Elise, which I actually did enjoy, but I just decided it wasn't quite the right thing for me. I think it's a lovely car, but it it handled well. I did a couple of track days with it. It was very good, but I just decided it wasn't quite the thing that I wanted to keep. And one car I did keep for a while, certainly sold it not too long ago, fairly humble, but it had been my road car for a while, was a VW Lupo GTI, one of the first ones.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a rapid little machine, and it was great fun, and I did enjoy that, yeah.
So is there sort of along the same kind of lines then, Ben, is there a motoring itch that you're yet to scratch? Is there something that you've always thought, one day I might get one of them? Is there anything that you've got your eye on that you'd love?
There's plenty of cars out there that I love. But actually, right at this moment, I haven't got a clear sort of idea of exactly what the next thing is. It's something to have a think about in the future. Effectively, when I sold the Lupo, what I've decided, and the Elise, because they both sort of went at a similar time, I bought a Toyota GR86. So,
Good car.
And I had seen the GT86 being incredibly high rated by so many people, both on road and for doing fun stuff with. I haven't done a lot with it yet, but I do like it, and so that's the thing to sort of be going on with next.
Oh, brilliant! So I guess we've got to ask the question, Dave, haven't we? And I suppose be a difficult question for you to answer, or to be truthful about, but it won't be. Electric cars, yay or nay?
Electric cars. That is a good question, because that sometimes I think, well, that would be a sensible thing. I'm just doing sort of fairly low mileage a lot of the time, not all of the time, but fairly low mileage. Can I, you know, run an electric car, keep it charged up, whatever? On the other hand, I'm a bit concerned about the future of electric cars, how they're running, their values, the way they drop down, their reliability. So it's not something that is appealing to me right now, but I do see that there is, you know, changes being made, modifications being made, seeing that through the racing that I was commentating on at the weekend. The technology is stepping forward all the time. And the fact that Formula E, for example, this year, one of the things they haven't started yet, but they're going to, is bring the cars in to charge in the pits and send back out. And part of the technology of that is learning how to charge an electric power unit incredibly much faster than it's being done at the moment. And that, for all of us, would make a huge difference, because we're also used to stopping at a petrol station or a diesel pot and filling up and carrying on for another several hundred miles. Whereas for electric, you've got to stop and wait while it's charging back up. Now, if they get this technology right in Formula E of recharging a battery to a certain amount, not necessarily the full amount, but very quickly, I think that's something that's going to develop everywhere.
This is something that we talk about a lot on here, Ben. I think also with regards to, and I totally understand your decision in terms of where you're, or rather your mindset in terms of where you are with electric vehicles, because I think we're all of that persuasion to an extent whereby it's a little bit like, and this is showing my age, it's a little bit like a kind of VHS and Betamax kind of situation, where you almost like sort of have two roads. There's a kind of fork, and which one are you going to go down? And I think in many ways, a lot of it hinges on what does or doesn't happen with synthetic fuels. Because if synthetic fuels are a viable future, then to an extent, that could... It doesn't make electric vehicles obsolete, but I tell you what, it very much weights the argument in favor of keeping internal combustion engines, I would suggest, because again, as we say every week on this thing, there's nothing more green than keeping existing hardware going in terms of, you know, the hardware that's on the road, but also, of course, the infrastructure, because every two-bit town on every continent, you know, has got a gas station somewhere, whether it's in the middle of Africa or the middle of South America or whatever like that, you know, and so the infrastructure is there. And if we can keep, you know, the existing hardware in terms of cars and trucks and whatever on the road, then that can surely only be a good thing.
I agree. And there's a lot of work going on. And, you know, I work with our commentating at Goodwood quite a lot nowadays. And they, you know, they're going down, they run so many historic cars, but they're using sustainable fuel more and more now and insisting that people have to use it. And that, you know, they've pushed hard for that. All of the races had to be run on it this year, in fact. And that's great that they're, you know, they're keeping some of the most valuable historic racing vehicles being shown at Goodwood. But this whole move of running on sustainable fuel is important too. So it's interesting because it's all going in both directions in development in different ways. How this is all going to actually work out in the future is very difficult to see. But it's really interesting watching the development on all areas.
Yeah, one thing's for certain is that the engineers and the scientists around the world, there's some really clever people out there. And they'll suss it out. The electric movement will suss out how to charge batteries faster, and they've got more range. And the internal combustion engine movement, e-fuels, will get proper e-fuel, and the price will come down. And that's great for everyone, isn't it? Yeah.
The engineers do a fantastic job, and I totally agree. The political system doesn't always pick up with it correctly. And, you know, one of the things that knocked me a little bit was, you know, in the days of diesel. When I grew up, it was around a farm where diesel, you know, everyone knew that diesels were very good on tractors, but they weren't used so much in cars at that time. Then suddenly there was this build up. We must use them. You know, it became a bit of a political thing almost to use diesel. And then suddenly it became a thing not to use, even though they became incredibly efficient with it. Sometimes the political side doesn't always follow the engineering side, I feel.
Hear, hear.
Here we go. Of all the cars that you've ever owned, and I think I might know which one, if you had to pick one and only one and stick with it for the rest of your life, it would be...
probably the Railton.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's been part of family for so long.
No, I understand that because, as you say, it's part of your family history, you know, and it's not just a car, is it? It's, as I say, it's a member of the family. So I totally understand that decision.
What did you think it was going to be, Jason?
Well, obviously, looking at you, knowing you for years, I thought you'd go for the Stag, old boy.
No, you see, I was leaning more towards the BMW Touring, the Alpine, just because of the practicality of it and the fact that, indeed, you know, not only do you love it and you enjoy driving, but also you can do tip runs in it, you know, which for men of a certain age is an important thing that we all have to do. Absolutely. And going on to something sort of slightly more romantic, this is where this is the question where we finish with everybody, Ben, and it's been wonderful having you on the show. But the final question is this one, in that we always say that music and cars go well together, we think. So we need your fantasy drive, please, Mr. Ben Edwards. Where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
Right. Okay. I didn't realize you were going to send me such a challenging question. Okay. Right. I'm going to have to think about this just a little bit.
That's all right. Thinking time is allowed.
Dave, have we got that background music we could just put on down? You know, like the stuff they play in shoe shops when you go and buy shoes. I mean, why did they do that? Why did they put that terrible music on?
I have no idea. Yeah. But it helps to sort of mask awkward gaps, doesn't it, I suppose, like we are now.
Well, so what car and where am I going to be driving? There have been so many beautiful places around the world. I've been very lucky with the travelling I've done over the years, covering both racing in America, because at one time I was covering effectively what is IndyCar now, Champ Car, covering Formula One, going to around the world, some amazing places. So there have been some incredible places that I've driven over the years and enjoyed. I think one of my favorite places, funnily enough, is probably California. That was a lovely part of the world near the Laguna Seca track down there. Did you ever race there, Jason, at Laguna?
No, I didn't. No.
No, it's a lovely place. I never drove it, but the region around there was a lovely part, and you can run along the coast. There's a highway that runs along the coast, and then there's some lovely places that you can go into, and a wine producing area as well. So that would probably be one of my favorite places to be driving along, and I'd probably be listening to a bit of Steely Dan on the music.
Nice.
Yeah, I've always been a bit of a Steely Dan fan growing up. And what will I be driving? Well, I think it's certainly in that part of the world, it would have to be an open top.
Yep.
It would be, yeah. Maybe I should go back to the Triumph Stag after all of this. Maybe I should go back to that Triumph Stag. For that one apart, I will go back to the Triumph Stag in California with the roof down.
How cool would that be? Down the PCH. How cool would that be?
Although the only thing with it, though, is that if you're in the Stag, would you not have to have those ridiculous great big bumpers on the front of it? Do you remember like when you used to watch Heart to Heart and stuff like that in the 80s, and they had those Mercedes convertibles with those huge, great, stupid bumpers? Wouldn't you have to have that and completely ruin the lines of the Stag?
Well, it depends. If I could take that, the one I had was all right. We didn't have those big bumpers, but you're right, because the MGBs all went down that route, didn't they? Because at that period, so they could actually be run in America. It was a bit of an element there, no doubt, no doubt.
Mate, Steely Dan down the Pacific Coast Highway. What's not to like about that? Calling into a little vineyard somewhere.
Oh. Yeah, in the Stag. I mean, it sounds perfect. It sounds like it should be a TV show, I think, actually. Yeah. And I think on that beautiful and rather perfect note Jason played, so I think you need to take us out.
Well, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thank you very much. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Ben Edwards.
Thanks, guys.
Ben, it's been wonderful. Thank you. A pleasure as always. Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Thanks again, folks, for listening, and we'll see you next time.